San Mateo County and Continuing Education and Health Sciences. I'd like to welcome you to our symposium this morning. This is the third program in as many years that our center has co-sponsored the University of California. And what is our effort to share with you some of the ideas, concepts, and concerns that we face in exploring and attempting to deal with the issue of suicide. Today we're focusing on a set of critical moral and ethical issues relating to suicide prevention. We've invited two individuals who have rather pronounced differences of opinion on these issues, opinions that have been publicly stated and have received much attention. What we hope to develop today is a dialogue between them, plus some responses from a panel of distinguished authorities, together with questions from this group. While it's not likely that we'll end today with any final answers, what we hope to do is move towards some synthesis between what at the outset appears to be totally different points of views. Our first speaker this morning is Dr. Thomas Szasz. Dr. Szasz was born in Budapest, received his AB and MD from the University of Cincinnati, his psychiatric training at the University of Chicago, and his psychoanalytic training at the Chicago Institute for Psychoanalysis. Since 1956, he's been a professor of psychiatry at the State University of New York at Syracuse. A frequent contributor to books and journals on philosophical, legal, psychiatric, and psychoanalytic subjects, Dr. Szasz is the author of Pain and Pleasure, Law, Liberty, and Psychiatry, The Ethics of Psychoanalysis, Psychiatric Justice, The Myth of Mental Illness, and The Manufacture of Madness. And among the numerous articles he has written was a most provocative one, which appeared in the Antioch Review, titled The Ethics of Suicide, which had a great deal to do with our putting together this symposium this morning. So if you'll close the back doors for just a while, I'll now introduce Dr. Szasz. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Ross. Mrs. Ross, Dr. Motto, Dr. Schneidman, fellow participants, and ladies and gentlemen. First, I want to ask if you can hear me. Only one person says no, which is pretty good, batting average. Or at least only one person I can see. I didn't have, and I don't have a prepared address, and especially since I see that the ethics of suicide is being distributed, I certainly won't read from it, though perhaps I will read a few paragraphs from it at the very end. Instead, let me, in an informal sort of way, let me run through what seems to me the essence of my argument about the problem of suicide and its relation to psychiatry and medicine and ethics, human rights. Now first, I want to make clear that in saying that suicide is a human right, I'm not saying that suicide is good. I'm saying that freedom is good. This is a rather simple point, but I think it's worth belaboring right at the beginning because it is frequently misunderstood or interpreted as if to assert that something is a right, it is therefore good. That's obviously not true. You have a right to vote for a president in a presidential election, for example. Assuming that you have two evil candidates, that right, obviously, is not a moral good, regardless of from who you vote, and in fact, not voting might be a morally preferable alternative. You have a right to buy stock, obviously. If you buy a stock that goes down, that's not good. You have a right to marry, to divorce. All of these rights, obviously, can be exercised in such a way that they are very far from something that's good. But what is a right? Actually, certainly those of us in medicine and psychiatry do not keep in mind that a right is a political concept. A right means, and it only has relevance, is in a particular political and legal framework. A right is something And this is essential. He's a classic libertarian, John Stuart Millian definition of it. Right is something about which or of which an individual has a reasonable, hopefully an enforceable expectation that the protection of which the state will enforce. That is a right. For example, you have a right, we have a right to life. If somebody threatens our life, we can call upon the state to enforce that right. If somebody threatens to kill us, we can call the police and that person will be taken into custody. If somebody threatens or takes our property, life and property are two fundamental rights, the possession of these things. And we can call upon the police power of the state, in this respect, the police power is sort of like going to Macy's or Gimbel's. We have a right to make certain purchases there. We have a right to call upon the police power of the state to protect us in these. Now, if we then assert that suicide is a right, what one is really saying is that one has a right to one's own life, including the taking of it. And if one wants to take one's own life, and somebody wants to prevent one from doing so, then one could call upon the police power of the state to prevent that other person from interfering with you. That's really what the right means. And we'll explain then that, obviously, in some highly pragmatic sense, the right to suicide is not unconditional, but would be hedged in by certain specific circumstances. That is how the person does it. If the person does it so as to actually, directly, not symbolically, injure somebody, then this right would no longer be his. But I only want to emphasize now at the beginning that to say that something is a right does not mean that it's good. Now, insofar then as I maintain that freedom of this particular kind, that is freedom to one's own life, including to take it, is a moral good, I think it would be reasonable to ask that do those who disagree with this view, or those who advocate suicide prevention along contemporary lines, do they mean that freedom of this particular kind is not good and should be subordinated to something else? But the second point that I want to discuss is equally elementary. And relates very much to contemporary discussion of suicide, rather than to the old-fashioned moral one. That is, nowadays, we don't say like we used to in the old days when people were religious and when suicide was opposed because it was the taking of a life which obviously didn't belong to a person, but if one was a good Jew or a good Christian, it was the taking of something that didn't belong to one, it belonged to God. That's a rather nice view. I personally don't hold it, but that makes sense. It has certain consequences also. That is, one then has to impose appropriate sanctions, and one has to have the guts to impose them if one believes in that kind of theological system. But very few people believe that now. So instead, suicide is opposed on the ground that when the person does it, obviously, since he wants to die, and since most everybody wants to live, he must be what is now our general explanation for everything we don't like. He must be mentally ill. So we have to dispose of the question of is suicide itself, quotes, mental illness, or what may be a more sophisticated but simply a more sneaky way of arguing this point, that it's not really a mental illness, it's a symptom of mental illness. That sort of suicide is like a high white count in pneumonia. The pneumonia being the mental disease called depression or schizophrenia or, you name it. And that the suicide is a symptom of it. Dr. Scriven is on the program, and while I can't speak for him, and since I'm not a philosopher myself, this strikes me as a rather idiotic twisted semantic argument to argue that a human act, a human performance, and after all, to commit suicide, to kill oneself, requires a certain amount of skill. Lower animals generally can't do this. Small children can't do this because it requires a certain concept of what one has to do in order to bring about one's own death. So this is not an entirely simple thing to do, not that it's so complicated for a human being, but it's a performance. Now, once you take the leap and say that a performance is a disease, and obviously then this is going to be a performance which somebody doesn't like is a disease, then you open the door to a chain of arguments, which I won't belabor this morning. I hope many of you know my views on this. But then you open the door to the general idea that anything which A doesn't like, that B is doing, is mental illness. And of course, it's not only suicide, but certainly homicide, war, killing a president, assuming you don't like him. If you like him, then you can hope he will commit suicide. This is not, I didn't make this up. Let me digress. I brought along a number of things to quote, and I might quote this one. Because, you know, we speak about suicide and so, suicide prevention and how everybody wants to prevent suicide. Well, there was an article in 1968 when Mr. Johnson was not exactly popular, entitled "Johnson Mocked as a Freak at His Unbirthday Party." The New York Times, August 28, 1968, page 32. I quote, "Today's party, sponsored by the Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam, was designed as a, quote, tribute to Mr. Johnson's historic career all the way from the first election he stole in Texas to the new anti-personnel weapons the administration has developed for use in Vietnam and the ghettos. The band crashed out a song called Master Hate, dedicated to the president. It went as follows. Suicide is an evil thing, but at times it is good. If you have been where the master lives, I think you surely should." So it depends, as the old Indian saying has it, whose ox is being gored. Certainly the idea that somebody should commit suicide that you don't like, whether it's Johnson or Hitler, is not very far from anybody's thought. So the question then is that also mental illness? Supposing Hitler would have gotten a little guilty about what he was doing, he would have killed himself earlier, as indeed he did it then. Would that be mental illness? All right, now, since I maintain that it is not mental illness, or a symptom of mental illness, which of course is easy for me to maintain, since I maintain that nothing is. I still think in some ways it behooves those who want to defend this position to defend it in some reasonable way. Now I can actually sort of escalate this argument and sort of double the bid, and turn it around and say, let's assume that it is an illness. I'll grant it that it is an illness, that suicide is an illness, or suicide inclination. It's just like pneumonia. Well, it seems to me even then I can make a rather good point, because our present medical practices and medical ethics is based squarely on the proposition that a doctor can intervene in an illness with an adult only with his consent. And if you have pneumonia, or if you have syphilis, or gonorrhea, or anything else, you not only have the opportunity to seek treatment for it, but you have a quite unconditional right, hedged in by some limitations, which have to do mainly with psychiatry, not with public health, have to do with being declared mentally incompetent, but you have the right to reject the treatment. Now, you have that right quite explicitly through the First Amendment. If you're a Christian Scientist or Jehovah's Witness, you can base it on that. But actually, you have it pretty much quite without it, by simply not going to a doctor, in which case he wouldn't even know that you are sick. Nobody would. So that operationally, the issue of treatment would not arise, because it generally has to be initiated by the patient. But even if you go to a doctor or go to a hospital and somebody wants to do something to you, let's assume you go to a hospital and with a stomach ache, and the doctor says, well, they examine you and they find that you have some kind of terrible cancer, and they suggest that they're going to cut out half your intestines and most of your liver and pancreas and everything else and transform you, what doctors like to do, from a human being into a case. So you can then live the rest of your life, however many days or weeks, as a case. And let's assume that you prefer not to live as a case. You then have the right to go home and live as best you can and die from the disease. That's quite a basic right. And really, medical and surgical practice is based on this. So it would seem that if suicide is an illness, then it would be reasonable to argue that while the person may seek help for it, in keeping with the general medical ethic, he should also have the right to reject any kind of involuntary treatment for it. Now, mind you, this is within the framework of the illness model. Now I come to another point. I'm really covering points which are generally raised in defense of suicide prevention of the conventional kind. And that point is that, well, after all, sometimes people have to be restrained a little or something has to be done, and then they change their mind and they're very grateful. Which is really, on the face of it, not an implausible argument, but there's lots wrong with it, and I want to show you what's wrong with it. Now, first, if you restrain somebody a little, what is that little? 24 hours, 72 hours, 72 days, 72 years? What is the time limit on this? Secondly, whatever the time limit is, and obviously if it's a temporary, highly temporary thing, one is usually thinking of a very short time, 2-3 days, 2-3 weeks. And I'm now going along with the idea for the moment, and I will in a minute also repudiate it on purely moral grounds. But pragmatically, this creates tremendous difficulties, as psychiatrists only too well know. And as there are many actual cases in the public literature, in the press, to illustrate it. Because once you get into this kind of a game with another human being, into this kind of interaction, then you have the problem of what happens if this temporary restraint does not work. You then have a psychiatrist on one side of the bar, as it were, and the patient, the person on the other side, and the expiration of a certain time, let's say a week or 2 weeks, at the end of which the person says, well, now it's very nice, the patient says, in effect, perhaps not in so many words, now it's very nice, you had your chance to cure me of this crazy idea of suicide, but you haven't succeeded yet, and as soon as you let me out of here, I'm going to kill myself. Now, if there were a true contract for temporary restraint, in a truly legal sense, then what the physician, the hospital, would have to abide by this. But this creates, it seems to me, something of a psychological and logical inconsistency, because if a person can announce at the end of 2 or 3 weeks of psychiatric hospitalization, now I will go out and kill myself, why can't he do that without the 3 weeks? In other words, if this is an illness, whatever the justification was 3 weeks ago would in some sense continue, except for the fact that it is now contractually annulled. Well, one could then equally well argue that it's contractually annulled at the very beginning. And this is really the moral argument against this temporary restraint, and that is, this whole idea rests upon the very old-fashioned, the very old and very really sufficiently discussed problem, to which I have nothing new to add, and that is the problem of ends and means. Do good ends justify bad or questionable means? Now, one says yes or no, or sometimes, or some compromise. By and large, I certainly would like to side with those people who say that good ends don't justify bad means, among other reasons, for the obvious one that life being what it is, one usually never reaches the ends. One only lives with the means. And good morality, therefore, really is synonymous with employing good ends always, good means always, and worrying about the ends, as it were, later. But that good means really are synonymous with good ends, not not to mention the fact that the two are really, in, you know, define each other. Now, if then it is acknowledged that forcible and fraudulent detention of a person is bad, then one needs no further argument to reject this argument of temporary restraint. Needless to say also that there is something naively unrealistic about this idea that if you only restrain somebody for a while afterwards, he will be grateful because, of course, the history of psychiatry as recorded through public figures is full of cases where the person was hardly grateful for this. Also, I propose this grateful idea. It is perfectly obvious that this is a species of what is perhaps best called generally, best categorized in the general rubric of paternalism, which is a guiding concept and ethic underlying all of involuntary psychiatry. And obviously, if one does not like paternalism, vis-a-vis adults especially, as I don't, then anything that's based on such a crassly paternalistic idea and principle can be simply rejected on that basis. That this simply means that the intervenor knows what's in the best interest of the person for whom he intervenes, very much as a parent does for a child. Now, these really cover the main points, and for what time I have left, let me illustrate to you some from some dramatic, or I hope dramatic, illustrations or quotations. Really, the extremely questionable, to me distasteful, methods that are used in suicide prevention, and perhaps necessarily so, because these many of these moral and political problems are not thought through, and as a result, the methodology, if one could call it that, of suicide prevention is essentially the application of force and fraud in the practice of a quasi-medical kind of enterprise. Now let me read to you one story which illustrates this very dramatically. This is from the biography of Marilyn Monroe. And names are, of course, named so that you see that we are dealing with the very best people in the field and how they act. I read to you about two pages from this biography, which is now in paperback, called Norma Jean. Presumably many of you have read it. As Marilyn's ability to function collapsed under the weight of sedatives, Dr. Marion Criss suggested that she enter, note the semantics, that she enter the Payne Whitney Clinic, a New York institution concerned mainly with mental and nervous disorders. Now, this is incorrect. The Payne Whitney Clinic is synonymous, as those of you from the East know, with the psychiatric division of the Cornell University Medical Center and Hospital. That she enter. Now, Dr. Marion Criss, as most of you would know, is a Viennese lady analyst, the very top of her profession. Psychiatrist, MD, training analyst, the works, New York Psychoanalytic Institute, the best. Now, notice how she treated Marilyn Monroe. You can imagine how lesser psychiatrists treat lesser people. I think that's a reasonable extrapolation. Marilyn was not told that she was being taken to a section of the clinic that housed the mentally ill. She agreed that she needed hospital care, however, and went inside with Dr. Criss. As they proceeded through the hospital, iron doors slid open and then slammed shut again. Marilyn was frightened by the security arrangements. Before she was even taken to her room, she looked around, wild-eyed, and asked, "What are you doing to me? What kind of a place is this?" Admission was completed, and Marilyn, under the name of Faye Miller, found herself in a room barren of any of the comforts which made her previous hospital stays something of a respite from the limelight. The windows were barred. The door opening onto the corridor had a transparent glass pane so that the patrolling nurses could glance inside as a precautionary measure. Marilyn was convinced that the aides, doctors, and nurses never failed to stare at her as they went by, a sort of cage celebrity and an interesting distraction from their routine. Obviously a delusional idea. Rumors abounded, and not even how the author slips into this disgusting psychiatric idiom and language. Rumors abounded about the form of Marilyn's rebelliousness at the clinic. A persistent one was that she once tore off her hospital gown to give the curious attendants something really to stare at. Really is italicized in the text. Whatever she did, she told Pat Newcomb, her secretary, that if they were going to treat her like a nut, she would behave like one. Within 2 days, Marilyn degenerated from a state of nervous tension into one of hysteria. What she hoped might be her salvation turned into a nightmare. John Springer, the publicity man representing her, was besieged by reporters from everywhere demanding to know the precise nature of her mental illness. He first professed ignorance that Pat and Whitney specialized in psychiatric problems, but few accepted his prepared story, which insisted Marilyn had been troubled only by a persistent cough. Now, such stupid, people are nowadays, I digress, and let me stop for a moment. I complain about the credibility gap in the Defense Department and in Vietnam. Now, I am not defending the war or the president or anyone else in this matter, but it is the business of politicians to lie. And everybody should expect that. But it is hardly the business of psychiatrists and doctors to lie like this, to expect people to be not to know what Pat and Whitney is or what psychiatry is. Later that same day, he decided that only a fairly straightforward account, this is now still Springer, the publicity man, that only a fairly straightforward account could scuttle the bizarre rumors appearing in the press. What bizarre, I don't know. His new statement informed newsmen that, quote, Marilyn was admitted for a period of rest and recuperation following a very arduous year in which she completed 2 films and had to face marital problems. It's expected her stay will not be prolonged. Now note, this imprisonment is called stay. But obviously she wanted to get out and they didn't let her. John Springer's prediction that her stay at Pitt Whitney would be brief proved indeed to be accurate. After 3 days of alternating fits of hysteria and despondency, as she gazed through the glass pane towards the busy corridor and then back to the dismal, barren room with its doorless toilet, another precaution, Marilyn finally was able to make one call, the first allowed to her in 3 days. Now, mind you, Marilyn Monroe had never been declared mentally incompetent. This entire procedure is totally illegal. And Dr. Marianne Criss was behaving in an illegal manner. But of course, what are the laws for, any more than what are they for minority groups or women or anybody else? A piece of paper. She called Joe DiMaggio for help. She had already been divorced from him. DiMaggio settled at his Yankee Clipper motel in Fort Lauderdale, assured Marilyn that he would fly to New York that evening and do all he could. It would not be easy. But Joe DiMaggio was still a person of considerable power in New York. The word power is the author's, and this author, who wrote his biography, is unsophisticated about psychiatry. He didn't say insight, or psychiatric knowledge, or compassion. He said power. He made a number of calls bringing influence and pressure. In fact, he called the mayor, I happen to know, to bear on the hospital. Next morning, Marilyn emerged from the clinic, clutching tenaciously to DiMaggio's arm. Now, mind you, these gangsters at the New York hospital did not release her at her own request. I don't have to tell you what would happen. I think it's a reasonable extrapolation what happens to lesser people who don't have this kind of power when they are caught up in this kind of suicide prevention. Now, it is not irrelevant to mention that, like many other celebrities about whom we know, despite these first-rate help, she killed herself. of suicide, and it seems to me not unreasonable that she was afraid that this kind of nonsense would be imposed on her again, unless things get sticky. Well, I would, my time is, how much more time shall I take? 3 minutes, okay. I want to mention in this connection, I have a couple of equally interesting items that I could read. Well, let me mention what is obviously, or not obviously, but certainly in my view, an aspect of suicide prevention and our attitude toward suicide. Obviously, if suicide is not an illness, one has to have some other interpretation of it. Now, my interpretation of it is that it's by and large simply an expression of the fact that human beings are free to do all kinds of things, including killing themselves. In other words, suicide has, in some very fundamental way, have to do with personal autonomy, with the fact that one is one's own master. Now, this idea is, unfortunately, hardly original with me. I wish it were. I think it was Aristotle, or if not Aristotle, some compatriot of his, and about the same time, who, while he believed that slavery was natural and slaves ought to be slaves because that somehow is the natural order and that's how God created them, he justified this ingenious view in a rather ingenious way. Namely, that slaves have such a stupid mentality that if they were like free men, obviously they would not remain slaves but would kill themselves to frustrate their masters. And since they don't generally do this, this proves that they ought to be slaves. Now, as you know, in Greek ethic, suicide was not an absolutely bad thing. And in fact, to lead a morally dignified life was far more important. And the culture hero of the entire Western world was a person, Socrates, who chose, in effect, suicide, execution, in preference to banishment, which, after all, is a form of life and which could have been commuted and so forth. So Socrates is a suicide. Not to mention that after all, the early Christians, who preferred to be killed rather than to be the loyal, converted heathen subjects of the emperor, in effect, committed suicide by preferring a certain kind of dignified death to life at any cost. And of course, I quote in my article, Patrick Henry's phrase, give me liberty or give me death. Now, obviously, this is a quasi-suicidal statement in a patriotic context. The point I'm making, then, that suicide is a very dramatic expression of the fact that the person, in effect, says, look, I am my own master and you can't bother me. And since there is an infinite human passion in the human bosom to bother other people and to control them, obviously, I think this is the reason why we don't like suicide. Now, this is very easy to illustrate. One, perhaps the best illustration, or an easy one for this, is the infinite pains to which people have gone in the Western world to prevent condemned prisoners from killing themselves. An obscenity. Now, why? If somebody is condemned to death, what the state wants, if what society wants, is that they should die, after all, one could put a bottle of sleeping pills in their cell and let them kill themselves. That, in effect, is how Socrates was treated. He was given poison, which he himself drank. He was not beheaded. He was not hanged. The brutalization of killing the person was not gone through. Well, we don't want this. The fact that the condemned person cannot kill himself, but society is going to butcher him, is an expression of the fact that he does not control himself. We do. Now, a rather cute example of this is the case of Hermann Göring, whose last heroic or unheroic act was to frustrate the American authorities, who had these high-ranking Nazis all caged in Nuremberg. And since we won, fortunately, we could declare them to have committed crimes against humanity, which is, after all, a luxury of victors. And as a part of this, obviously, they're going to kill them. And there were immense precautions, because it was well known that as part of the Nazi stoical ethic, which I am hardly here to extol, they believed that suicide was preferable to some kind of ignominious death, and it was quite routine for them to have cyanide capsules in their possession. And they were searched for this, and I guess Goering's was hidden in one of his bodily orifices. At least that's the only presumption, where it was not discovered. And as you know, well along during the Nuremberg trials, while they were in process, I think more than halfway through, I'm not entirely clear on this particular detail, it's not important. One morning, Goering killed himself. And it is quite obvious that this was a victory for Goering and no one else. And that in this sense, suicide was a very dramatic expression of his own autonomy. And of course, similarly, Hitler and all the other leaders killed themselves not to fall into captivity. And of course, that old military idea that leading generals, leading statesmen and so on, kill themselves rather than be captured. That is, at the point of utter defeat, they kill themselves. And in Japan, of course, this is still quite accepted. But I don't have to digress into the comparative anthropology of suicide. I mean, no one in this country really defends the idea that suicide is mental illness or bad everywhere. I mean, that would be a very difficult point to maintain. But let me quote to you now, I think my time is running out, and I want to read to you one other story which illustrates in a dramatic way the principle that the ends justify the means in this business. Really, no one questions this. I think that is really, generally people don't question this. This is generally accepted. Otherwise, how else does one explain stories like this? And these are, after all, fairly routine. I clip these things from the paper as they strike my fancy about some of these subjects. This is from the New York Times only a couple of months ago. This February, I imagine, in anticipation of coming here, I noticed this. It's fairly short. Let me read this and then stop. Policeman priest thwarts a suicide. This is the title of the piece in New York Times. Policeman priest in quotes, thwarts a suicide. Somerville, Massachusetts, the Associated Press. A policeman posing as a Roman Catholic priest. So we begin with a crassly immoral and illegal act. This is where we start. A policeman posing as a Roman Catholic priest talked a distraught husband threatening suicide into surrendering a pistol. The man, identified as Ernest Gibbons of Newton, Kansas, was taken to Cambridge City Hospital for psychiatric observation. Translate psychiatric imprisonment. The police gave this account of the incident. Mr. Gibbons appeared at his estranged wife's home recently and after a discussion produced a .38 caliber pistol. He threatened to kill himself. Mrs. Gibbons, mother of a child, screamed and neighbors called the police, who said that when they arrived, Mr. Gibbons had the muzzle of the gun in his mouth. For 3 hours, the police sought unsuccessfully to persuade him to surrender. At length, Bernard Regan, a patrolman, went to nearby St. Joseph's Rectory and asked for a cassock and Roman collar, saying the man's life was at stake. Dressed as a priest, Mr. Regan talked his way into Mrs. Gibbons' home and negotiated with her husband for an hour. However, he suddenly realized that he had forgotten to take off his wedding ring. and that the blue piping of his police trousers were showing beneath his cassock. But Mr. Regan apparently wasn't paying attention to that. Oh, Mr. Gibbons, rather. Mr. Regan said Mr. Gibbons made the discovery at about the same time, cocked the pistol and pointed it at him, then apparently at second thoughts, and let the loaded weapon fall to the floor. Other officers rushed in and overpowered Mr. Gibbons. Now, I won't belabor this. What else is there to say? It really is a question of do these ends justify such means. Now, while we are on the issue of religion, let me add one more thing to this, which I think is an important point. I suppose if it wouldn't come up now, it would come up later. But let me add that. I have really no objection, that's putting it mildly, I'm quite in favor of having clear religious and moral rules, which of course are quite separate from legal rules in a society that's not theological. In other words, the idea that suicide is a sin is quite nice. It's not my personal view, but that makes sense to me. Now, of course, that means really two things. And I want to hammer this point home to show really how far the psychiatric ideology of fraudulence has carried even religion and how religion has come out. It really means two things if you think that suicide is bad. Of course, first of all, it means that you yourself don't do it. That's what a moral rule means. Not that you impose it on someone, but that you don't do it. Secondly, it means that you have appropriate theological, religious sanctions. Now, this is not something esoteric we are talking about. We are talking about here, what I'm talking about here, is the fact that it is part and parcel of the Roman Catholic religion that a person who commits suicide, commits a grievous sin against his religion, against God, and the penalty for this is that the priest must not bury him in a religious ceremony. This is a prescribed penalty. This penalty, of course, used to be routinely enforced, carried out. As far as I know, in the last good many decades, certainly in New York State, upstate New York especially, which is a heavily Catholic area, nothing like this would ever occur to anyone, because we now live, including the clergy, live in a very enlightened age. They all do what the American Medical Association, whenever it's called upon, denounces this practice, although obviously all psychiatrists love to engage in it, and that is the making of a retrospective psychiatric diagnosis about somebody who is dead. When the Catholic clergy is now faced with a Catholic who committed suicide, they bury him, as they do everyone else, because obviously the person killed himself while insane, and therefore committed no sin. Thank you very much.
You were going to use that question and answer period very thoroughly today. I am going to assume that there may be some more things to be said. Let's take a couple minutes here just to allow those in the back to get seated. Assuming there aren't seats. Okay, if you all try to find some seats now, we'd like to continue. And I'll formally thank Dr. Saz for his comments, and I think you can see why we're
very, very interested in what he has to say. And now, I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Edwin Schneidman, Professor of Medical Psychology and Director of the Laboratory for the Study of Life-Threatening Behavior in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California at Los Angeles. He was the first chief of the Center for the Studies of Suicide Prevention at the National Institute of Mental Health, has served as visiting professor in the Department of Social Relations at Harvard University, and from 1969 to 1970 as a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study of Behavioral Sciences in Stanford. He's editor of Life-Threatening Behavior and the associate editor of Accident Analysis and Prevention. His publications include Clues to Suicide, The Cry for Help, Essays in Self-Destruction, Aspects of Depression, On the Nature of Suicide, The Psychology of Suicide, and scheduled to appear in July, Death in the College Student. His latest book, which is in press, is titled The Deaths of Man. Dr. Schneidman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mrs. Ross, members of the panel, I'm going to read my extemporaneous remarks. At the end of one of his typically brilliant papers, Dr. Henry Murray, physician psychologist at Harvard, says the following: "If I have said anything that I ought to be sorry for, I am willing to be forgiven. I say this now at the beginning of my presentation, for it will soon be apparent that I do not agree entirely with everything that Dr. Saz has to say. I need to add that I first laid eyes on him only this morning. I trust it will be clear, at least from this moment on, that what I have to say is directed entirely toward his ideas, positions, and attitudes, and not at all proposed personally in any ad hominem spirit. Out of my general reverence for the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and what it stands for, I welcome this debate, feeling A, the truth will out, B, feeling almost contradictorily that there are very few final truths, and C, feeling that no one has a stranglehold on veridicality and wisdom. The importance of this occasion and the obvious nature of my special responsibilities in it demand that I begin pointedly in earnest. Personally, I am in a somewhat unusual position. On the one hand, my opponent in this forensic altercation, and I point out that while we're debating, we are not competing for a single political office. It's very different from a political debate. But my opponent in this debate is an acknowledged, experienced physician, a brilliant intellect, an articulate exponent of his own position, and a well-publicized polemicist. On the other hand, it is clear in my mind that the burden of the main position which he seriously espouses in print and on this platform on the topic of suicide prevention is philosophically naive, clinically flawed, therapeutically inimical, badly informed, speciously reasoned, and ethically troublesome. I promise not to make any ad hominem remarks. But that does not preclude my making a general statement about myself. I am appalled, I guess you might say I have deep moral indignation, at the potential for mischief and neglect which I find in his position relative to suicide prevention. But that is not all that troubles me. If there is any special fervor in my presentation, it is because I am concerned especially for the young people who are involved with suicide prevention. Young professionals, volunteer helpers, suicidal persons. Lest Dr. Saw's reckless foray into this field, where he's obviously not an expert, and grinding a special axe better suited for other choppings, could have irremediably demoralizing effects if these young people were to take him seriously. Now, it's not only fair, but it seems required that at the outset I lay out some of the tenets of my own position in relation to suicide. First, I would begin by defining suicide as the intentioned act of self-destruction. It is not a disease, although one can, if one looks hard enough, find some who think so. It is not an immorality, although it's often been so treated. And it is unlikely that any one theory can ever explain phenomena as varied and complicated as human self-destructive acts. At the least, suicide involves an individual's tortured and tunneled logic in a state of intolerable, inner felt, idiosyncratically defined anguish. In his recent stunning and beautiful book, The Savage God, the English critic and poet A. Alvarez touches on this admixture of thought and feeling, the intellectual and the emotional aspects of suicide, when he says, quote, "Each of these suicidal deaths has its own irresistible and fatal inner logic and unrepeatable despair," close quote. This mixture of thought and emotion, what I call affectelligence, is infused with both conscious and unconscious psychodynamics, playing themselves out within a social and cultural context of various degrees of social restraint and social facilitation. Further, I believe that it is more useful to conceptualize inimical acts along dimensions of lethality than to put them into the usual categories of attempted, threatened, and committed suicide. I'm also partial to the concepts of subintention death and life-threatening behavior. By temperament, I am somewhat against the use of the word successful and unsuccessful as adjectival to suicide. My basic attitude is definitely for the prevention of self-inflicted deaths, not at any price in the world, but with a great deal more fervor than Dr. Saw's position would seemingly be willing to invest. I'm a devout believer, as a citizen, as a psychologist, and as a suicidologist, in Justice Cardoza's ringing judgment that a cry for help is a summons to rescue. In this setting, I wish to focus briefly on three general psychological features which I consider to be characteristics of suicidal phenomena. The first is that acute suicidal crisis, or the period of high and dangerous lethality, is an interval of relatively short duration, to be counted typically in hours or days, not usually in terms of months or years. An individual is at the peak of his self-destructiveness for a very brief time and is either helped, cools off, or is dead. Although one can live for years at a chronically somewhat elevated self-destructive level, one cannot, in a state of heightened lethality, have a loaded gun to one's head for too long before either bullet or affect is discharged. The key question is, if it is true that the acute suicidal interval is a relatively short one, then why, in the name of common sense and humanity, would anyone focus on an individual's wishes to kill himself during that relatively brief period in his life and disregard the vast panoply and remainder of his existence, especially when the potential rescuer knows that the potential victim will, given some appropriate response, change the balance of forces within his own mind and himself wish to continue to live? I receive no sense from reading Dr. Saw's materials that he is aware of this key characteristic of suicide, nor aware of the concept of gradations of lethality. The second concept is ambivalence. In this audience, few people would dispute that Freud's major insights relating to the role of unconscious motivation and the workings of what we can call the unconscious mind have been one of the giant ideas of this century, revolutionizing our ideas of man. Dr. Lippmann's paper on Freud and suicide is already an acknowledged classic, and I recommend it to you. The notion of ambivalence is a critical concept in 20th century psychodynamically oriented psychiatry and psychology. The dualities, complications, concomitant contradictory feelings, attitudes and thrust toward essentially the same person or introjected image is a recognized hallmark of psychological life. These dualities in the mind's flow constitute a cardinal feature of man's inner life. One can no longer ask, in an Aristotelian way, to make up your mind. To such a question, a sophisticated respondent ought to say, "But that is precisely the point. I am at least of two, perhaps several minds on this subject." Dr. Murray has described this internal flux, the mental flux as the Congress of the mind. Now, I need to point out that actions, to pull a trigger or not to, are characteristically dichotomous. But the debate which leads up to an action can, in the Congress of the mind, be a very complicated set of inner dialogues. A law has equal force whether it is passed in the Senate by a 100-0 or a 51-49 vote. So has a bullet. As a professor of psychiatry speaking to another professor, as a professor of psychology speaking to a professor of psychiatry, I say Dr. Sass seems to be breathtakingly innocent about this fundamental psychodynamic notion. The paradigm of suicide is not the simplistic one of wanting to or not wanting to, as that view proclaims. There is a confusion of those of the conjunction. There is a great difference between love or marriage and love and marriage. The prototypical psychological picture of a person on the brink of suicide is one who wants to and doesn't want to. He makes plans for self-destruction and at the same time entertains fantasies of rescue and intervention. It is perfectly possible, indeed probably prototypical, for a suicidal individual to cut his throat and to cry for help at the same time. These dualities are all about us. Sacred and profane love, as in the recent book, The French Lieutenant's Woman, and Melville's book, Pierre. Intellect and control on the one side versus affect and experience in Hesse's Narcissus and Goldmund. We can no longer say if he wants to. The person is who is univalent about committing suicide is already dead. What would one do with a person on a ledge? That person wants to die or he wouldn't be on the ledge. He'd be inside the building. And that person wants to live or he wouldn't be on the ledge. He'd be splattered on the pavement below. Should one ask the person what he wanted? Obviously, the person on the ledge is conflicted. Or should one reach out at all, be a good Samaritan, a benign intervener, even if it meant restricting that person's freedom for a moment? Or should one just leave him to continue his inner debate, perhaps to jump or even to slip or fall? On this issue, I'll quote from Dr. Saz's paper. Quote, the suicidologist has a literally schizophrenic view of the suicidal person. He sees him as two persons at one, each at war with the other. One half of the patient wants to die, the other half wants to live. The former, says the suicidologist, is wrong. The latter is right. He then proceeds to protect the latter by restraining the former. However, since these two people are like Siamese twins, one can restrain the suicidal half only by restraining the whole person. Close quote. One hardly knows what to say to that. Of course the suicidal person is in conflict. Who is not? That buzzing Congress of the mind is in constant debate. It's the most characteristic fact of human life. Perplexities and conflict and ambivalence are what psychological life are made of. To deny that in the 20th century is too simplistic for words. But I need to say a special word about that last sentence. However, since there are two people like Siamese twins, one can restrain the suicidal half only by restraining the whole person. At the end of the quote, if we change the focus of our concern from restraining to saving, then does it not make as much sense to say that the beneficent suicidologist can save the suicidal half only by saving the whole person? The third characteristic I want to mention is that most suicidal events are dyadic events. That is, they are two-person events. Actually, this dyadic aspect of suicide itself has two aspects. One during the prevention of suicide, when one must deal with a significant other. And the second aspect is in the aftermath of a committed suicide, in which one ought to deal with a survivor victim. Although it is obvious that the suicidal drama takes place within an individual's head, it is also true that most suicidal tensions are between two people, typically rather well known to each other, spouse and spouse, parent and child, lover and lover. In addition, we can reflect that death itself is an extremely dyadic event. In the last few years, this view has been presented in the most lucid and poignant form by the well-known historian Arnold Toynbee in the moving epilogue to his recent book, 1968, Man's Concern with Death. Toynbee.